him in, stunned at how wrong everything seems to be going. "You don't seem to be very keen to go to Thailand," he says, handing me candles to stick in the cake. "Yet you were the one who suggested it."
"Well, it's just that it doesn't seem such a good idea with your court case coming up."
"So you think it would be better for me to cancel it?" Blessed relief floods through me. "Definitely." "Then do you think Millie will be able to move in with us earlier? Next week, for example. In fact, she could even stay behind today, and I could drive up and collect her things during the week while she settles into her lovely red bedroom. What do you think, Grace? Shall I go out and suggest it? Or shall we go to Thailand next month?" "We'll go to Thailand next month," I say stonily. "I thought that's what you would say. Now, where are the matches?" It's hard not to give in to the desperation I feel as I sing "Happy Birthday" along with the others and applaud as Millie blows out her candles. I look around at everybody laughing and joking together and struggle to understand how my life has become a living hell that nobody present could ever begin to imagine. If I were to suddenly demand their attention and tell them that Millie is in great danger from Jack, that he intends to keep her locked up in a terrifying room until she goes mad with fear, that he is in reality a murderer who has kept me prisoner for the last 15 months, nobody would believe me. And what would Jack tell them in return? That he only realised once we were married that I had a history of mental illness. That it only became apparent on our honeymoon, when I accused him of keeping me a prisoner in front of a lobby full of people, that the hotel manager, our local doctor, and the police would be happy to confirm that I am unbalanced. That the last 15 months have been a terrible strain on him, especially as he has to accompany me everywhere for fear of what I'll say in public. Even if Millie were to come to my defence and accuse him of pushing her down the stairs, he would look appalled and say that I must have put the idea into her mind. Why would the people gathered here today believe my version over Jack's, when his sounds so much more plausible? We eat the cake, drink more champagne. Millie and the children resume their games, and the rest of us sit around chatting. I have trouble concentrating, but when I hear Janice saying that she'll enjoy coming to see Millie in our beautiful house, I seize the chance to make it a reality. "Why don't we fix a date now?" I turn to the others. "And maybe we could take Millie and the children to the music festival and have a picnic there. They seem to be getting along well. Doesn't it start at the beginning of July?"
"What a good idea," Diane exclaims. "And is anybody interested in a trip to the zoo? I've promised to take mine as soon as school breaks up."
"Millie would love that," I say, eager to fill her diary. "Before you get carried away, Grace," Jack interrupts, "I have another surprise for you. Well, for you and Millie, actually." I feel myself go cold. "Another surprise?"
"Don't look so worried," Moira jokes. "Knowing Jack, I'm sure it'll be something nice."
"I didn't really want to tell you yet," Jack says apologetically to me, "but as you're making all these arrangements for the summer holidays, I think you should know that I'm taking you and Millie to New Zealand to see your parents."
"New Zealand," breathes Diane. "Gosh, I've always wanted to go to New Zealand."
"When?" I stammer. "Well, I thought we'd give Millie a few days to settle in and leave around the middle of July," he says.
"But Millie's meant to be starting work at the garden centre in August," I say, wondering what he's playing at.
"It's a long way to go for a couple of weeks." "I'm sure they won't mind if she starts a week or two later, especially if we explain why."
Don't you think it'll be too much for Millie, going to New Zealand so soon after moving in? Surely it would be better to wait until Christmas."
"I think she'll be thrilled," Janice intervenes. "She's been dreaming of going since we did a class project on New Zealand, just after your parents moved there."
"If I went to New Zealand, I'm not sure I'd want to come back,"
says Diane. It's meant to be quite beautiful.
That's one of the dangers, of course, agrees Jack. Millie could end up loving it so much that she might ask to stay there permanently with her parents.
The pennies begin to drop, and I realise that he's preparing Millie's exit from society.
She would never do that, I say fiercely. For a start, she would never leave me.
But what if you decided to stay there too? Jack asks.
His tone is playful. But I understand only too well that he's preparing the ground for my exit as well.
I wouldn't, I say. I could never leave you, Jack. Surely you know that.
But I could kill you, I add silently. In fact, I'm going to have to.
Past. The pile of pills under my mattress gave me a new lease of life. For the first time in 6 months, escaping from Jack became a real possibility, and I felt humbly grateful to Millie for stepping in and forcing me to take charge again. After the trouble she had gone to get me the pills, I was determined not to let her down. But I needed to plan carefully. Not least of my problems was the fact that the pills were an unknown quantity. Even if I managed to get them into Jack, I had no idea how long it would be before they started to take effect, or what that effect would be. And how many pills would it take to knock him out? There were so many variables, so many ifs and buts. I began by looking for a way to get them into one of Jack's drinks. The only time we ever took a drink together was when we were at dinner with other people around, and if my plan was to work, I would have to get him to take the pills here, in this house, while we were on our own. I spent the night considering every possibility, and by the time he brought me my dinner the following evening, I already had an idea of how I could do it, but I needed to start laying the foundations at once. I made sure he found me sitting despondently on the bed, my back to the door. When I didn't turn around and take the tray, as I usually did, he placed it beside me on the bed and left without saying a word. Just knowing that the food was there was difficult, especially as I hadn't eaten since lunch with Millie the previous day, but I was determined not to eat it. The next day, he didn't bother bringing me any food at all, but as the tray was still there and I was even hungrier, it was hard not to be tempted. But whenever I considered giving in and eating just a little to stave off the hunger pangs, I conjured up a picture of the room in the basement and placed Millie inside it. Then it was easy. On the third day, mindful perhaps that he had neglected to feed me the day before, Jack brought me breakfast. When he saw that the tray he had brought me 2 days previously was untouched, he looked at me curiously. Not hungry? I shook my head. No. In that case, I'll take your breakfast back down to the kitchen. He left, taking both meals with him, and without food around it was easier. To help me ignore the hunger pains, I meditated, but when I still hadn't eaten anything by the weekend, nor touched any of the wine he had brought me, Jack got suspicious.
You're not on some kind of hunger strike, are you? He hazarded as he picked up another tray of uneaten food and replaced it with a fresh one.
I shook my head lethargically. I'm just not hungry, that's all.
Why not?
I took a while in replying. I suppose I never really thought it would come to this, I admitted, picking nervously at the bed cover. I always thought that, in the end, I'd find a way of saving Millie from you.
Let me guess. You thought that good would triumph over evil, or that a knight in shining armour would come along and rescue you and Millie from your fate.
Something like that. I let a sob catch my throat. But it's not going to happen, is it? Millie is going to move in with us, and there's nothing I can do about it.
If it's any consolation, there never was anything you could do about it. But I'm glad you've begun to accept the inevitable.
It will make everything easier for you in the long run. I nodded at the glass of wine on the tray he'd brought me, trying to ignore the chicken and potatoes that looked so delicious. I don't suppose I could have a whiskey instead of the wine, could I?
Whiskey?
Yes. I didn't know you drank whiskey. And I didn't know you were a psychopath. Just bring me a whiskey, Jack. I went on, rubbing my eyes tiredly. I used to drink it with my father, if you must know. I felt him looking at me, but I kept my head bowed in what I hoped was a picture of misery. He left the room, locking the door behind him. I had no way of knowing whether he would bring me the whiskey I'd asked for, and the smell of the chicken was so tantalizing that I began a slow count, promising myself that if he hadn't come back by the time I got to 100, I would eat the lot. I wasn't even at 50 when I heard his footsteps on the stairs. At 60, the key turned in the lock, and I closed my eyes, knowing that if he hadn't brought me a whiskey, I would probably burst into tears, because the effort of denying myself food for almost a week would have been for nothing. Here. I opened my eyes and looked at the plastic cup he was holding out to me. What is it? I asked suspiciously.
Whiskey.
I made to take it, but he pulled his hand back. First eat.
You'll be no good to me if you're too weak to look after Millie.
Although his words chilled me, they also told me that I was on the right track, because he had never given in to any of my demands before, not even when I'd asked for a larger towel to dry myself with. But I suppose that with his end goal in sight, he couldn't afford to let anything happen to me, which meant he was more likely to give in to any requests I made as long as they were reasonable. It was a major triumph, and although I had planned to hold out a little longer before eating, I reasoned that if I wanted Jack to bring me more whiskey, I would have to meet him halfway. But I wanted him to bring it to me as soon as he got in from work. I wanted him to get into the habit of pouring my whiskey at the same time as he poured his. I asked for whiskey because I hoped it would give me an appetite, I said, my arms still outstretched. So can I have it, please? I expected him to refuse, but after a small hesitation, he handed it to me. I raised the cup to my lips with pretend eagerness. The smell made my stomach turn, but at least I knew it was whiskey I was about to drink, and not something else. Conscious of his eyes on me, I took a sip. I had never drunk whiskey before in my life, and the bitter taste was a shock.
"Not to your liking," he mocked, and I knew he didn't really believe that I liked whiskey, and had only given it to me to find out what my real motive was in asking for it in the first place.
"Have you ever drunk whiskey out of a plastic cup?" I demanded, taking another sip. "Believe me, it doesn't taste quite the same. Maybe you can bring it in a glass next time." I raised the cup again and knocked the whole lot back.
"Now, eat something," he said, pushing the tray towards me.
My head spinning from the whiskey, I put the tray on my lap. The food looked so good, I would have been capable of clearing the plate in 15 seconds. It was hard not to wolf it down, but I made myself eat slowly, as if I had no pleasure in what I was tasting. I only allowed myself to eat half of it, and when I put my knife and fork down, I'm not sure who was more disappointed, me or Jack.
"Can't you eat a little more?"
he frowned. "No, sorry," I said unenthusiastically. "Maybe tomorrow." He left, taking the tray with him, and although I was still hungry, the taste of victory was sweeter than anything I could have eaten. Jack wasn't stupid. The next day, when I didn't eat anything again, he decided to hit me where he knew it would hurt me most.
"I'm cancelling our visit to Millie tomorrow," he said as he picked up the untouched tray. "There's no point taking her out to lunch if you're not going to eat."
I'd known there was a risk he wouldn't take me to see Millie, but it was a sacrifice I was willing to make. "All right," I shrugged. From the look of surprise he gave me, I knew he'd been expecting me to insist that I was well enough to go, and I was glad I had wrong-footed him. "Millie is going to be so disappointed," he sighed. "Well, won't be for the first time." He thought for a moment. This wouldn't be some little ploy to get me to cancel Millie's birthday party, would it? It was a conclusion I hadn't expected him to come to, and one that was far from the truth, but I wondered if I could get it to work in my favour. "Why would I want you to do that?" I asked, playing for time. "You tell me." "Maybe you should try and put yourself in my position for once. If Millie comes here, she's going to fall in love with this house. How do you think that's going to make me feel? Knowing what you have in store for her, and knowing I can do nothing to prevent it from happening." "Let me guess," he pretended to think for a moment. "Not good?" I willed tears of self-pity into my eyes. "Yes, that's right, Jack. Not good. So bad, in fact, that I'd prefer to die."
"So, this is some kind of hunger strike, then?"
"No, Jack, of course it isn't. I know that Millie is going to need me. I know I have to keep my strength up. But I can't help it if I've lost my appetite. I'm sure most people would, given the circumstances." I let my voice raise an octave. "Have you any idea what it's like for me on a day-to-day basis, not being able to choose what I want to eat or when I want to eat? Have you any idea what it's like to have to rely on you for absolutely everything? To sometimes have to wait 2 or 3 days for food because you decide I need punishing or can't be bothered to bring me anything? You're not exactly the most generous of jailers, Jack."
"Perhaps you shouldn't have made so many attempts to escape," he snapped. "If you hadn't, I wouldn't have needed to confine you to this room, and you would have led a perfectly decent life with me."
"Decent? With you controlling my every move? You don't even know the meaning of the word. Go on, Jack. You punish me. Deprive me of food. See if I care. If I don't eat again for a week, at least I'll be too weak to attend Millie's birthday party next Sunday."
"You'd better start eating again," he threatened, realizing the truth of what I'd said.
"Or what, Jack?" I taunted. "You can't force me to eat, you know." I paused. "But as it isn't in Millie's interest that I die, or in yours, why don't you do us both a favour and pour me a whiskey in the evenings when you pour your own, and my appetite might come back a little?"
"I call the shots around here, remember?" he reminded me.
However, when it came to food, he no longer did. Realising that he needed to keep me healthy, he began to do as I'd asked. I made sure that I never ate much, because it was important he thought I really had lost my appetite, but it was equally important that I ate enough to merit the small amount of whiskey he brought me when he got in from work. By the time Millie's party came round, I was confident I'd be able to achieve my aim before Millie came to live with us, 2 months down the line, as long as nothing happened to interrupt the routine of Jack bringing me whiskey every evening. Present. I stand in front of the house, my case at my feet. The double gates are shut, but the small gate, the one that I came out of, is ajar. I hear Esther's car approaching, and turning back towards the house, I give a little wave. She pulls up next to me, gets out, and opens the boot. "I could have come all the way to the door, you know," she reproaches, helping me to lift my suitcase into the car. "I thought it would save time. Thank you for coming to fetch me at such short notice." "No problem," she smiles. "But we're going to have to hurry if you're to make your flight." As she closes the boot, I wave towards the house again, blow a kiss, and pull the gate closed behind me. "I wish he was coming with me," I say fretfully. "I hate leaving him when he's so down." "It's the first case he's lost, isn't it?" "Yes, I think that's why he's taken it so hard. But he did think the husband was guilty, or he wouldn't have taken it on in the first place. Unfortunately, Dina Anderson was less than truthful with Jack and hid certain things from him, including the fact that she had a lover. It seems he was the real culprit. Well, I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but I expect he'll tell me when he joins me. It's funny, I used to travel all over the world on my own, yet the thought of spending a few days alone in Thailand is disconcerting. I'm so used to having Jack with me. I'm not quite sure what he expects me to do for the next 4 days. Have a nice rest, I suppose. I would rather have waited for him, but he was so insistent, I go on. And I know better to argue with him when he's made up his mind about something. I look over at her. You see, he can be a little imperfect sometimes. Insisting that you go ahead of him on holiday is not imperfect, she reminds me. No, I suppose not. Once he explained that he wouldn't enjoy the holiday if he had to face all the paperwork when he came back, I understood better. He really needs to be able to relax on this holiday, especially as it's probably the last we'll be able to have on our own. It's normal that he prefers to stay and get everything filed away, although I rather think that if he'd won the case, he wouldn't have minded quite so much about being reminded of it when we got back, I add ruefully. He probably wants to lick his wounds in private, she agrees. You know what men are like. The thing is, we're hoping to conceive a baby while we're in Thailand, which is another reason he wants to be completely relaxed. It's about the right time, I admit, blushing a little. She takes her hand off the wheel and gives mine a squeeze. I really hope it works out for you both. Well, if it does, you'll be the first to know, I promise. I can't wait to have Jack's child. He was so disappointed when I had my last miscarriage. He tried to be strong for me, but it really affected him, especially when I didn't conceive again immediately afterwards. I told him that these things take time, that my body needed to recover first, but he began wondering if it was down to him and the demands of his job, you know, the stress and everything. Do you think he'll want to come round for dinner or something, over the weekend? To be honest, I think he'd rather stay and plough through his paperwork, but you could always ask him, although I'm not sure you'll be able to get hold of him as he doesn't intend answering his phone over the next few days. He already had to deal with the media when he came out of court this afternoon, and he knows they're going to be on his back over the next few days. But you can always leave a message on his voicemail. That's what he told me to do if I can't get through to him, especially with the time difference and everything. And he's joining you on Tuesday? Yes. Well, early Wednesday morning. He's taking the Tuesday evening flight. Although he did say he might be delayed a day or two. But I think he was joking. At least, well, I hope he was. So you'll only have 4 days on your own. Gosh, what I wouldn't give for 4 days of peace. Does he need taking to the airport on Tuesday? Rufus would do it. No, it's fine. Adam offered, but Jack's going to take the car and leave it at the airport. We'll need it for when we get back. The flight gets in around 6 in the morning, and we wouldn't ask anyone to come and pick us up at that ungodly hour. I'm surprised how easily we chat on the way to the airport. I was expecting a far more uncomfortable ride, but she seems content to talk about the most ordinary of things. She asks if she and the children could go and see Millie at the weekend, and maybe take her out for tea, and remembering how well Millie and Aisling got on at the party, I agree gratefully, glad that Millie will have some visitors while I'm away. She asks me to let Janice know that they'll call by on Sunday, and I promise that I will. We arrive at the airport with 15 minutes to spare. She drops me off at departures and leaves me with a cheery wave. I go into the terminal building, find the British Airways counter, check in my case, and make my way to the departure lounge. Then I take a seat in the corner and wait for my flight to be called. Past. Until the day of Millie's party, I never really thought I would kill Jack. I dreamt about it often enough, but in the cold light of day, I balked at the thought of killing another human being. It was probably why my attempt to stun him with the bottle failed. I'd been too scared to hit him any harder, in case I killed him. There was also the fact that if I did kill him, I would almost certainly be sent to prison and be held in custody while I waited trial, which would be terrible for Millie. So all I wanted was to knock him out long enough for me to be able to escape from him. But the minute he mentioned taking me and Millie to New Zealand, I knew I was going to have to kill him, whatever the consequences, because getting away from him would never be enough. "So that's how you're going to do it," I said bitterly once we'd waved Millie and Janice off after the party. "You're going to shut up the house, pretend we've all gone off to New Zealand, and then suddenly reappear on your own, and tell everyone that Millie and I have decided to stay over there, when, in reality, we'll be hidden away in the basement." "More or less," he confirmed. "Except that it'll be too much trouble to shut up the house and pretend I'm not here, so I'll find an excuse to send the two of you on to New Zealand ahead of me. And in the end, I'll be so delayed it won't be worth joining you, because you'll be practically on your way back. And then, just as I'm about to leave for the airport to pick you up, I'll get a tearful call from you, saying that Millie refused to get on the plane and that you, torn between loving husband and lunatic sister, didn't get on the plane either. And, loving husband that I am, I'll tell everybody that because I know how difficult it's going to be for you to leave Millie behind, I've given you permission to stay on a little longer. Except, the little longer will become a lot longer. Until one sad day, you'll tell me you're never coming back. And because I'm broken-hearted, people won't dare mention your name to me, and eventually, they'll forget that you and Millie ever existed." "And my parents?" I demanded. "How will you explain our disappearance to them?" "I'll probably just kill them. Now, get up to your room." I turned away from him so that he couldn't see how much his words had shocked me. Finding a way out, killing Jack, had never seemed more urgent, and I knew that if I went back to my room, another opportunity would be lost. It was time to put the next part of my plan into action. "Can't I stay down here a while?" I asked.
"No."
"Why not?"
"You know very well why."
"When was the last time I tried to escape? Look at me, Jack. Do you really think you're in danger from me? Have I done anything except behave as perfectly as possible for the last 6 months? Do you honestly think that I want to risk going down to the basement?"
"It's true that your trips down there seem to have had the desired effect. But, nonetheless, you'll be going up to your room."
"Then, could I move into another room?"
"Why?"
"Why do you think?" "Because I need a change of scene, that's why. I'm fed up looking at the same four walls, day in, day out."
"All right."
I looked at him in surprise. "Really?"
"Yes. Come on, I'll take you down to the basement, and you can look at the four walls there instead. Or do you think that maybe your room isn't so bad after all?"
"I think maybe my room isn't so bad after all," I said dully.
"That's a shame. You see, I think the room in the basement has been empty for far too long.
Shall I let you into a secret?" He leant down towards me and lowered his voice to a whisper.
"It was hard, very hard, to let Millie leave just now. Much harder than I thought it would be. In fact, it was so hard that I'm going to suggest she moves in as soon as we get back from Thailand. What do you think, Grace? Won't it be lovely to be one happy family?"
I knew then that not only would I have to kill Jack, I would have to kill him before we left for Thailand. Terrible though it was to realise how little time I had left, having a deadline helped me focus. As I went up the stairs in front of him, I was already planning my next move. "When you bring me up my whiskey, Will you stay and have one with me? I asked as I got undressed.
Now, why would I want to do that?
Because I'm tired of being cooped up for 24 hours a day with no one to talk to, I said listlessly. Have you any idea what it's like? Sometimes I feel as if I'm going mad. In fact, I wish I would. I let my voice rise. What would you do then, Jack? What will you do if I go mad?
Of course you're not going to go mad, he retorted, pushing me into my bedroom and closing the door.
I might, I called after him. I just might. And I want my whiskey in a glass.
I don't know whether it was because he'd refused me everything else I'd asked for, or if he was worried that I really would go mad. But whatever the reason, when he came back 10 minutes later, he was carrying 2 glasses.
Thank you, I said, taking a sip. Can I ask you something?
Go ahead.
It's about the Tomasin case. He married an actress, didn't he? Dina, somebody or other. I seem to remember reading something about it, back in the days when I was allowed to read newspapers.
Dina Anderson.
So, is she accusing him of beating her up?
I'm not allowed to discuss my cases.
Well, everybody here today seemed to know about it, so either you haven't been very discreet, or it's common knowledge, I said reasonably. Doesn't he give most of his fortune to good causes?
It doesn't mean he's not a wife beater.
What did Adam mean about her having a lover?
Adam was just being provocative.
So there's no truth in what he said?
None at all. One of the tabloids invented the story to discredit her.
Why would they do that?
Because Anthony Tomasin is one of their shareholders. Now, drink up. I'm not leaving here without the glass.
Once he'd left, I took the screw of tissue out from under my mattress and opened it. I counted out the pills. There were 20 in all. I had no idea if that would be enough to kill Jack, especially as I was going to have to use someone myself, first of all to find out how strong they were, and secondly, to see if they would dissolve in liquid once they'd been crushed. Going into the bathroom, I tore 2 sheets of toilet paper from the roll and, after a lot of deliberation, put 4 of the pills between them, hoping it would be enough to knock me out without making me ill. I put the paper on the floor and crushed them as best I could with my foot. I had no cup to put the resulting granules in, so I used the top from my shampoo bottle as a receptacle and added some water. They dissolved a little, but not quite enough, and as I drank them down, I knew I'd have to find a way of grinding the rest of the pills into a finer powder. I started to feel drowsy some 15 minutes later and fell asleep almost immediately. I slept solidly for 14 hours, and when I woke, I felt slightly groggy and unbelievably thirsty. As Jack was almost twice my weight, I reckoned that 8 of the pills would have more or less the same effect on him, but that 16 wouldn't be enough to kill him outright. It was a major blow, as it meant that I'd have to find a way, once he was unconscious, of finishing everything myself. But even though I wanted him dead, I wasn't sure that when it actually came down to it, I would be capable of going down to the kitchen, fetching a knife from the drawer, and sticking it into his heart. I decided not to think that far ahead, and concentrated instead on getting Jack to stay a little longer with me when he brought me my whiskey in the evenings, reiterating what I'd told him before, that I felt as if I was going mad with no one to talk to all day. I hoped that eventually he would feel comfortable enough to start bringing up a whiskey for himself, as he had on the day of Millie's party, because if he didn't, I would have no way of drugging him. My lucky break came when the Tomasin case didn't turn out to be as straightforward as he expected. A week into the court case, as I sat on the bed, sipping the whiskey he'd brought me, and listened to him moaning about the number of character witnesses Anthony Tomasin had brought in, I told him he looked as if he could use a drink himself, and he went down to fetch one. From then on, every evening, he brought up 2 glasses, and when he began to linger longer than before, I understood that he needed to talk about what had happened in court that day. He never discussed the case with me in depth, but from what he said, it was obvious that Anthony Tomasin was putting up a robust defence, with a string of influential people attesting to his good character. The case began to drag on, and because Jack never mentioned our trip to Thailand, I presumed he had cancelled it, or at least postponed it. On the evening before we'd been due to leave, Jack came up to my room, carrying the usual 2 glasses of whiskey. "Drink up," he said, handing me a glass. "You need to pack." "Pack?" "Yes, we're going to Thailand tomorrow, remember?" I stared at him in horror. "But how can we go away if the case isn't over yet?" I stammered.
"It will be tomorrow," he said grimly, swilling his whiskey in his glass.
I didn't realise the jury were out.
"They've been out for 2 days. They've promised the verdict before lunch tomorrow."
Looking at him closely, I noticed how drawn he looked. "You are going to win, aren't you?" He knocked back most of the whiskey.
"That stupid bitch lied to me."
"What do you mean?"
"She did have a lover."
"So it was him?"
"No, it was her husband," he said stonily, because he couldn't bring himself to say anything else, not even to me.
"Then you've got nothing to worry about, have you?" He finished his glass.
"You don't know how glad I am that we're going to Thailand. If I've failed to convince the jury, it'll be the first case I've ever lost, and the press can have a field day. I can see the headlines already. Fallen angel, or something equally trite. Right, have you finished? It's time to pack."
As I took clothes out of the wardrobe in the bedroom next door, with Jack looking on, I hoped he wouldn't notice how shaken I was. I threw them into the case without giving any thought to what I was doing, preoccupied by the knowledge that the following day, when he came back from court, I was going to have to kill him, long before I planned to, because I'd foolishly counted on our holiday being cancelled. But he too seemed lost in thought, and realising how much winning meant to him, I felt anxious about the sort of mood he'd be in when he came back the next day. If he lost, he might insist on leaving for the airport straight away to get away from the press, even though our flight was in the evening, which meant that I wouldn't have time to drug him. That night, I prayed as I had never prayed before. I reminded God of all the evil Jack had already done, and all the evil he was going to do. I thought about Molly, about how he had locked her up and left her to die of dehydration. I thought about Millie and the fate he planned for her. I thought about the room in the basement. And suddenly, I had the answer to my problem. I knew exactly how I could make sure that he died. It was perfect. So perfect that if it worked, I would literally get away with murder. Present. It's only when the flight takes off that I begin to relax a little. But I know that even when I arrive in Bangkok, I'll be looking over my shoulder the whole time. I doubt the feeling of menace will ever leave me. Even the fact that Millie is safe at school isn't enough to allay my fears that Jack will somehow get to us. I had thought to bring her with me. I had wanted to tell Janice that Jack had given Millie his place on the plane and ask her to bring her to the airport. But it's better that she isn't involved in what's to come. I'm going to have a hard enough time keeping my nerve. To have to watch over Millie at the same time might prove too much for me. After everything I've been through in the last few hours, the slightest thing could make me lose the control I'm trying so hard to maintain. But I remind myself that there will be enough time to let my mask slip a little when I arrive in Thailand. once I'm behind closed doors. Going through passport control in Bangkok is a nightmare. The fear of Jack's hand on my shoulder never greater, although it would have been impossible for him to have got here before me. Even so, I find myself checking the face of the taxi driver before I get into his car to make sure it isn't Jack sitting behind the wheel. At the hotel, I'm warmly greeted by Mr. Ho, the manager who wrote the letter about me, and when he expresses surprise that I'm alone, I express equal surprise that he hasn't received Mr. Angel's email asking him to look after me until he arrives. Mr. Ho tells me he will be delighted to do so, and commiserates when I tell him that work commitments have kept my husband from joining me until Wednesday. I sense the manager hesitate. Is it possible, he asks, that my husband, Mr. Jack Angel, is the Mr. Angel mentioned in some of the English newspapers recently, in relation to the Anthony Tomasin case? I admit, in strictest confidence, that he and my husband are indeed one and the same, and that we hope we can count on him to be discreet, as we would rather nobody knows where we're staying. He tells me that he heard on the international news yesterday that Mr. Tomasin was acquitted, and when I confirm that he heard correctly, he says that Mr. Angel must have been disappointed. And I tell him that, yes, Mr. Angel was very disappointed, especially as it was the first time he's lost a case. As Mr. Ho signs me in, he asks me how I've been keeping. A delicate nod to my mental state, and if I had a good flight. When I tell him that I found it hard to sleep, he says the least he can do for such a good client as Mr. Angel is upgrade us to one of their suites. The relief I feel that I won't have to go back to the room where I realised I had married a monster is so great I feel like kissing him. Mr. Ho insists on escorting me to my new room himself. It crosses my mind that he might wonder why we always stay in one of the smaller rooms when Jack is such an illustrious lawyer. So I make sure to mention that my husband likes to maintain anonymity when we're on holiday, rather than draw attention to himself by throwing money around. I don't quite put it like that, but he gets the gist. Once Mr. Ho has left, I turn the television on and search for Sky News. Even in Asia, the Tomasin verdict is big news, and as they show Anthony Tomasin addressing reporters as he came out of court the previous day, Jack appears in the background, besieged by journalists. Unable to watch any longer, I turn the television off quickly. I'm desperate for a shower, but there are two calls I need to make. One to Janice, and the other to Jack, to tell them that I've arrived safely. Luckily, both are numbers that I know by heart. Jack's from when I first met him, and Janice's because it's the most important number in the world. I look at my watch. It's 3 PM local time, which means it's 9 AM in England. As the wife of Jack Angel, I make sure to get my priorities right and call him first. I have a momentary panic when I realise that any time over the past year, he could have changed his number. So when I get through to his voicemail, I feel weak with relief. I take a deep breath to steady myself and leave the sort of message a loving wife would leave. The sort of message I might have left had I been able to carry on living the dream. Hello, darling, it's me. I know you told me you might not pick up, but I was rather hoping you would. As you can tell, I'm missing you already. But maybe you're still in bed? Anyway, I've arrived safely and, oh, guess what? Mr. Ho felt so sorry for me being on my own that he's upgraded us to a better room. Even so, I know I'm going to hate being here without you. Anyway, I hope the press aren't hounding you too much and that you're managing to get through all your paperwork. Don't work too hard, and if you've got a minute, please call me back. I'm in room 107, otherwise I'll try you again later. I love you. Bye for now. I hang up and dial Janice's mobile. At this time on a Saturday morning, she and Millie should have finished breakfast and be on their way to the stables for Millie's riding lesson. When Janice doesn't answer immediately, my heart pounds with fear, in case Jack has somehow managed to get to Millie after all. But eventually she does, and while I speak to her, I remember to mention that Esther and her children will be calling in to see Millie the next day. Then I speak to Millie, and just knowing she is safe, at least for the time being, makes me feel better. I walk into the bathroom. The shower stands in the corner, concealed behind opaque doors, which means I can't use it as there's always the possibility, however slight, that I may come out and find Jack standing on the other side of them. I look at the bath and work out that if I leave the door open, as well as that of the bedroom, I'll be able to see through to the sitting room and so the main door. Reassured, I fill the bath, strip off my clothes, and lower myself tentatively into the hot water. As it rises up around my shoulders, the tension that engulfed me the moment I heard Jack step into the house at 3 o'clock the previous afternoon melts away, and I begin to cry in huge, racking sobs which tear from my body at an alarming rate. By the time I manage to pull myself together, the water is so cold I'm shivering. Climbing out, I wrap myself in one of the white toweling robes provided by the hotel and go into the bedroom. I'm desperately hungry, so I pick up the room service menu. I'm going to have to leave my room at some point if I'm to carry on pretending that everything's all right, but I can't. Not yet. I order a club sandwich, but when it arrives, I'm too frightened to open the door, even with the chain on, in case I find Jack standing there. Instead, I call for the tray to be left outside my room, which isn't much better because there's still the possibility that he'll be lurking in the corridor, waiting to bundle me back inside as soon as I open the door. Finding the courage to open the door wide enough to pull the tray into the room is a major triumph, and I wish I'd thought of ordering a bottle of wine along with a sandwich so that I could celebrate. But I remind myself that there will be plenty of time to celebrate later, when it's all over. Approximately 5 days from now, if my calculations are correct. Whether they are or not is something I have no way of knowing. At least, not yet. When I've finished eating, I unpack my case and look at my watch. It's only 5:30, and because nobody would expect me to go down to dinner alone on my first night in the hotel, I feel justified in staying in my room for the rest of the day. Feeling suddenly exhausted, I lie down on the bed, not really expecting to be able to sleep. But I do, and when I next open my eyes and find that the room is in darkness, I leap out of bed, my heart thumping in my chest, and run around the room, turning on all the lights. I know I'm not going to be able to sleep again for fear of opening my eyes and finding Jack standing over me. So I resign myself to spending a long night with only my thoughts for company. When morning comes, I get dressed, pick up the phone, and dial Jack's number. "Hello, darling. I wasn't really expecting to get you because it's 2 in the morning in England, so you must be fast asleep, but I thought I'd leave a message for you to listen to when you wake up. I meant to phone you before I went to sleep last night, but I lay down on the bed at 6 in the evening and only just woke up 10 minutes ago, which just goes to show how tired I was. I'm going down to breakfast in a minute, but I've got no idea how I'm going to spend the rest of the day. Might go for a walk, but probably just hang around the pool. Will you give me a ring when you wake up? You can always leave a message at the reception if I'm not in my room. I feel an awfully long way from you, which I am, of course. Anyway, I love you and miss you. Don't forget to phone me." I make my way down for breakfast. Mr. Ho is on duty. He asks if I slept well, and I tell him that I did. He suggests I eat out on the terrace, and I cross the lobby, remembering all the times Jack walked me across it on the way to the dining room, his hand gripping my arm tightly while he whispered menaces in my ear. Once outside, I help myself to fruit and pancakes and find a table in the corner, wondering if anyone else in the world has been as fooled by a man as I was. It seems strange that I'll never be able to tell anyone what I've been through. Never be able to tell them about the monster I was married to. Not if everything turns out as well as I hope it will. I eat slowly, needing to pass the time, and as I eat, I realize that if I crane my neck, I can see the balcony of the room on the 6th floor where I spent so many lonely hours. I sit there for over an hour, wishing I'd brought a book with me. Sitting on my own with nothing to distract me might look suspicious, as there can't be many people who go on holiday without taking a book with them, except those that leave in a hurry. I seem to remember Jack walking me past a second-hand bookshop on our way to take photographs of the two of us having a wonderful time in Bangkok. So I leave the hotel and go in search of it. I find it easily. It's the sort of place I love. But I feel too conspicuous to linger, so I buy a couple of books and return to the hotel, marvelling that I can feel relatively safe in a place that once held such horrors for me. In my room, I change into a bikini and go down to the pool, arming myself with a book and a towel. As I climb out of the pool after a swim, I notice a couple of men looking in my direction and prepare to tell them, should they decide to come and talk to me, that my husband is arriving in 2 days' time. I eke out the time until 3 o'clock by reading my book and swimming, then leave the terrace and go up to my room, where I leave a disappointed message on Jack's mobile. "Jack, it's me. I was hoping you'd have phoned me by now, but you're probably still asleep, which can only be a good thing, as I've been worrying that you're driving yourself into the ground working 24 hours a day. I've been at the pool all morning, so I'm going to go for a walk now. I'll phone you when I get back. Love you." I wait in my room for an hour or so, then go down to the lobby and, with a quick wave to Mr. Ho, who seems to work 24 hours a day, go out through the main doors. I walk around for a while, find myself in a market and spend some time buying silk scarves for Janice and Millie. I buy some postcards, search for a bar, order a non-alcoholic cocktail, read my book, write my cards, and wonder how I'm going to be able to fill in the next couple of days. I head back to the hotel and am immediately cornered by Mr. Ho, who wants to know if I'm enjoying myself. I confide that I'm at a bit of a loss without Jack, and ask if I could perhaps book an excursion for the following day. He tells me about an overnight trip to ancient temples that some of the hotel guests are going on, and asks me if I'd be interested in joining them. It's the perfect solution, but it's important that I don't look too eager, so I hum and hum a little and ask when exactly we'd be back, pointing out that Jack is due in on Wednesday morning. He promises that I'll be back at the hotel on Tuesday evening, and after a bit more hesitation, I let myself be persuaded. I add that because I'm going to have to get up extra early the next morning, I'll probably just have dinner in my room, and he agrees that it's a good idea. I go up to my room and phone Jack once again. "Hello, darling. Still no message from you, so I can't help wondering if you've gone to Esther's for lunch. She said she'd invite you over at some point. I told her you'd probably be too busy, but maybe you needed a break. Anyway, I just wanted to let you know that I've decided to go on an overnight trip to some temples, leaving early tomorrow morning. Mr. Ho suggested it, and at least it'll pass the time until you get here. I hate the thought of not being able to speak to you before Tuesday evening, which will be Tuesday afternoon for you. I'm definitely going to buy a mobile when we get back to England. But I'll phone you as soon as I get back to the hotel and hopefully catch you before you leave for the airport. I thought I might come meet you off the flight. I know you said not to, that you'll make your own way here. But maybe after being apart from me for 4 days, you'll have changed your mind. I can't wait to see you. You may as well know that I'm never going away without you again, no matter how much work you have. Well, I'd better go and throw a few things together. Remember, I love you very much.
I'll speak to you Tuesday. Don't work too hard. The next morning, I go on the trip and attach myself to a lovely middle-aged couple who, when I explain that I'm on my own because I'm waiting for my husband to come out and join me, take me under their wing. I talk to them about Jack and about the brilliant work he does on behalf of battered wives with such conviction that I almost believe it myself. They end up putting two and two together because they've read the papers, and I end up admitting that Jack Angel is indeed my husband. Fortunately, they're discreet enough not to mention the Tomasin case, although I can tell that they're itching to. Instead, I tell them about Millie, about how much we're looking forward to her coming to live with us, and how grateful I am to have such a wonderfully accepting husband. I tell them about our house, about Millie's yellow bedroom, and about the party we gave her for her 18th birthday just a few weeks before. By the time we get back to the hotel, later on Tuesday evening than expected, they've become firm friends, and as we go off to our rooms, I accept their kind invitation for Jack and me to have dinner with them once he arrives. In my room, I look at my watch. It's almost 11 o'clock, so 5 in the afternoon in England. It's plausible that Jack could already have left for the airport, so I phone his mobile and get through to his voicemail. This time, I make sure to sound dismayed. Jack, it's me. I've just got back from the trip to the temples, later than expected, and I can't believe you're still not answering your phone. I hope it doesn't mean that you're still working, because you should be leaving for the airport soon, unless you're already on your way. Look, could you phone me as soon as you get this message, please, just to let me know that everything is on schedule for you leaving tonight? I know you told me you'd be incommunicado, but I expected to be able to speak to you at least once before you left. And I, you know, hoped to find a message waiting for me on my phone here. I don't mean to nag, but I'm beginning to get a bit worried by your silence. I hope it doesn't mean that you want to tell me you're not coming until Thursday, by any chance. Anyway, please phone me as soon as you get this message. Don't worry that I'll be asleep. I won't be. I wait for half an hour or so, try his number again, and when it goes through to his voicemail, I leave an "It's me again, please phone me" message. Half an hour after that, I simply give a sigh of frustration before hanging up. Going over to my bag, I take out Jack's business card and call his office. A receptionist answers, and without giving my name, I ask to be put through to Adam. "Hello, Adam, it's Grace." "Grace, how are you? How's Thailand?" "I'm fine, and Thailand is as lovely as ever. I thought you might still be in the office. I'm not disturbing you, am I?" "No, it's fine. I was in a meeting with a client, but he's just left, thank goodness. It's one of those cases that I don't particularly want to take on, but his wife is determined to take him to the cleaners, and I can't help feeling sorry for him. Not that I'm letting my emotions get in the way, of course.